Thank you all for coming. I see a lot of familiar faces. And for those of you who have been participating in the Fourth Regional Plan workshops, the presentation, very brief presentation that I'm going to give is going to seem pretty familiar. The format here is that I'm going to give a brief introductory presentation on this topic. Then I'm going to introduce very briefly the panelists. And then I'm going to sort of sneak way over to the end and just kind of watch the maybe drop the occasional word, but I'm going to let Trent Lethko actually facilitate the discussion for about a half an hour, 40 minutes, and then we're going to open it up. There'll be no other presentations other than this initial one. And I want to say, just to put this one in context, you know, one of the things that's really different about the Fourth Regional Plan is that we're turning a different eye to the suburbs than we have before. The suburbs are really in crisis. They've changed tremendously, and there's going to be a different level of interest and effort around the suburbs in this plan than there has been in the past. And as you saw in the presentation, we're making very, very ambitious ideas about how the region can grow, how much growth it can accommodate. And if it's going to, we're going to really have to reinvent the suburbs. And when I say reinvent, I'm talking about not just about sort of putting more stuff in downtown, although that's where we're going to direct a lot of the growth. But we have to figure out some way to reclaim a lot of the places that we've kind of abandoned, of which these are some. So what are suburban corridors and why do we care? Now that you're all here and the doors are locked, there's a little bit of a bait and switch here in that what we're going to talk about definitely impacts what we think of as the Strip. But I want to say that one of the things that we're thinking about when we talk about suburban corridors is the larger geography that is on either side of the right-of-way, that is way beyond the Strip. So even though this is a very high scale, a very high altitude image of Route 110 in Suffolk County, where we're doing a lot of our work, this is more like the kind of geography that we're thinking about, not what happens between the two curb lines. Because what we've found, I'll show you that in a moment, but the amount of growth that these places have attracted is that you have conditions like this along Route 110 in Suffolk County, where you have a sort of model, new urbanist, dense, walkable community that is probably within less than a quarter of a mile of Route 110, but you cannot get from here to what could be a potential transit corridor. So, and similarly along Route 110 are these office parks that actually have about a third of the employment of the Suffolk County's office employment. So these places are kind of too big to ignore in terms of the amount of growth that they have been getting. This map, which I realize is hard for you all to read, so you'll have to kind of take my word for it. We've done this sort of giant land use map for the region. We've highlighted out of that, we have these different place types that we've been looking at, are the retail and commercial corridors. You might recognize some of them. This is the 287 corridor that is up in Westchester. This is Route 110, again, and many smaller ones. And here's the problem. These places have been attracting only, and that's what these colors correspond to. These are primarily residential areas. This is the core. These are these commercial areas. And these corridors, these larger geographies around these roads, have actually been attracting about 8% of the population, but 37% of the employment over the last 10 years. So these places are getting a tremendous amount of very much unbalanced growth. So we can't just ignore what's going on there. Of course, the problem, and even if I didn't label which mode was which here, you would guess very easily that, you know, a huge amount of development here, it's all auto-oriented. Few little blips of transit that you see here. I don't even know if the bars for walking and biking and so on are big enough to show up on this graph. So they're tremendously auto-dependent. The other reason we care is because the amount of potential for future growth in these places is extraordinary. I mean, this is a study that we did for Route 22 in the Somerset County Regional Center, which I'll also talk about in a moment. And by the time we finished doing this plan and made various suggestions for redevelopment, We were capturing 85% of Bridgewater's projected office growth, something that we thought could have something like 2.5 times the net positive fiscal impact of sprawl as of right development, and saving roughly 200 acres of open space across the Somerset County Regional Center. The other problem, of course, is that permissive zoning has enabled us, as population has had to go further out, to successively cannibalize each of these by going further out, developing new ones, leaving the old ones behind. So you're left with this incredible blight burden on the inner ring communities. So these are the kind of four high-level recommendations that we're going to talk about today. I won't read them here because I'm going to go through them briefly in sequence. So the first thing is to identify the what we're calling these sort of corridors of opportunity. And because there's so much of this stuff in the region, that even with all of the extraordinary growth that we're going to get, we could never kind of fill them up. And so the idea is, well, how do we pick the ones that we want to double down on? And so we've been developing a set of screening criteria, and that can be one of the things that we all talk about this morning, that have to do with whether or not a corridor actually connects things, whether or not it already has some level of transit service. That would be a kind of a threshold thing to know. How much transit connectivity is there? Does the corridor cross other modes, other rail lines in the region? Is there already a kind of a, can you get a critical mass of stuff there that can support transit service? And as I said, you have these conditions like Central Park Avenue in Greenberg and in Westchester, where you have really, really high density housing sort of up on a plinth away from the corridor, huge amount of commercial square footage and a lot of surface parking to kind of find those places where sort of you can really add more and turn it into more of a place. And of course, equity impacts. We look at places where if we add more growth here, we can actually get more employment and housing in communities that really need it. Once we would do that, to start thinking about how we could begin to infill it, particularly from a residential perspective, since we know that these places have been attracting a huge amount of commercial growth. So really turning them into places. So that's one idea, is to sort of find these places that really make sense, create a kind of typology of them, and then double down on them, figure out how to get growth to go to them. The other one is to change state and county road design standards. And this is a case where what seemed like relatively small, non-design-oriented and boring to urban designer issues, like the turning radiuses of trucks, changing some of those standards and access standards have a huge impact on what actually you can do with land use and redevelopment. And we know that standard DOT guidelines, which I just pulled these out of the book, you know, there's like no context whatsoever. You really wouldn't know where you were in the world. But NACDO and others have been coming up with context-sensitive design guidelines where they're actually looking at the kinds of changes that you can make to take that same truck and accommodate it in intersections that would also make walking and other modes possible. And also looking at the land uses along the road. Again, this is out of NACDO. And a lot of this stuff exists. The problem is that it hasn't been adopted into practice, into real, both at every level of government. So that's another one of the things we really want to do in the fourth plan, is actually work on getting these county and state road standards changed. The other thing we want to do is to try to establish multi-jurisdictional partnerships to implement coordinated planning. And I'll say, having worked on the Route 22 project, this is one of the areas, I think, for all the talk about home rule, I think as with watersheds, I think even the most determined home rule communities understand that this is not a problem that they're going to solve within their own municipal boundaries. And there are models for this. There's the I-35 Corridor Coalition north of Minneapolis, where there is a kind of a shared entity that has both elected and appointed officials from each of the municipalities. They have a written shared power agreement, so they actually coordinate with each other on land use decisions. And we don't have to go all the way to the Midwest to kind of talk about that. the Route 22 project again is part of the Somerset County Regional Center, which is actually made up of Somerville, Raritan, and portions of Bridgewater Township. And they similarly, they have a civic group of government appointees, both elected officials and people from industry, civic groups, who coordinate. They do the sort of intermunicipal master planning. And then to kind of work with the abutting communities to actually, we're interested in this larger geography, but we know you have state highway standards that are have design guidelines, but are really looking from a jurisdictional point of view at what they can do within their right-of-way. Then you have the abutting communities who have their own land use regulations, which somehow have to be knitted together in order to get sort of the land use and the transportation policies here to work. And the idea, of course, that this is sort of a favored project to always show in Minneapolis, again, north of Minneapolis, the Excelsior and Grand project. This is the before and the after. And then finally, to introduce new transit options along these corridors. And I think this is, and I want to say that, you know, part of the challenge here for us is that with the amount of growth that we're projecting to happen in the region, the kind of, if you were to try to do a map of origins and destinations of trips in that landscape, it would be absolute buckshot. It would be something that defies the ability, even if you had the money, to build a lot of new trunk rail lines and so on. You wouldn't be capturing as many of the trips that are happening at different times of the day, asymmetrical trips that are going to multiple destinations. So after we figured out how to get the best possible bus, or maybe there would be fixed guideway in some cases, but let's say it's bus along some of these corridors, how do we irrigate that into the larger landscape? And that's where these ideas of combined mobility really come into play. And this idea that you have to be able to make it seamless to move between every conceivable mode, from car sharing to car rental to bikes to walking to Uber. And there are, in smaller geographies, great examples of this, particularly in Europe. The Hanover card in Germany, the one card enables you to literally do everything, from rent a car to rent a bike to get on any mode. I mean, you think about the situation we're in New York where I can't get out of the subway with my Metro card and swipe it to get a bike, right? So if we're going to sort of irrigate into this larger landscape, some of it maybe will crawl back, but a lot of it is a legacy that's going to be there. We're going to have to get really creative about irrigating from the corridor out into the larger landscape. That's all I'm going to say in terms of a kind of introducing it all. I'm going to give the briefest of introductions to the panelists, and not in any particular order, other than the order in which I scribbled them here. Steve Ballone, who's Suffolk County executive, has been a longtime partner with us at RPA. I know Steve from some of the early mayor's institutes that we did out on Long Island when inadvertently going through this. Let me just get it out of the way. And Steve is now the county exec in Suffolk County. You all saw him on the main stage a moment ago. Steve really gets it in terms of trying to address both issues of economy and economic development, and has done things at every scale, from really seeing through the Hurricane Sandy rebuilding to smaller models like Wyandanch Rising. And Steve, I thought it was interesting you talked about models. In some ways, that's the way we're thinking about these corridors, is whether or not there are, since we can't redesign them all, whether or not we need to somehow develop a typology of them for different communities. Seth Pinsky, the Executive Vice President at RXR Real Estate Development, who do creative economic development, not only in the five boroughs, but in the suburbs and suburban downtown. So he'll have a perspective on this, certainly. Before that, he was part of the Special Initiative for Rebuilding and Resiliency after Sandy, and also the former president of the Economic Development Corporation in New York City. Lynn Richards, also a friend and colleague, now the CEO of the CEO of the CNU. It sounds like a roll-off-your-tongue kind of thing. Before that, at the EPA, Office of Sustainable Communities. And Gary Toth, who also a longstanding colleague who was at New Jersey DOT, and actually before all of us, before context-sensitive design was a glimmer in our eyes, Gary Toth was trying to do that at NJDOT, and he's now a senior director at Project for Public Spaces. And finally, Trent Lethko, who's a principal at ARUP, who's also a transportation planner by training, but has also an urban designer and has looked for ways to bring his transportation expertise to this problem. So with that, I'm going to kind of sneak over there and just kind of listen in and let Trent. And the format will be that Trent will kind of facilitate a discussion here for 20 minutes, half an hour, and then we're going to open it up for discussion with all of you.
And I probably don't have to facilitate too much because I think I have a lot of people who are
have
a great conversation amongst themselves. But we do have a few questions we wanted to ask our panelists to speak to before we break it open into a general discussion. RIT had challenged us to have a spirit of optimism when we think about the fourth regional plan and what we should be doing towards the future. And I thought about that comment as we came in here to talk about suburban retrofit, and I thought that's a real mashup in terms of optimism and challenges that we face in urban suburban retrofits and rethinking what suburban environments mean and how they work and how people live their lives. And I think, Executive Ballone, you've got a couple of pretty ambitious visions for Suffolk County. I think one is the innovation zone and everything that's going on in terms of trying to strengthen and build on the assets in the county for science and technology and leveraging all of the universities and the research facilities that are there. And you've also joined that up with Connect Long Island and having a connectivity strategy that brings all those nodes and all those activities together and also creates new opportunity. And I was curious to know, what was it in your mind that fused those two initiatives together? And then what are some of your concerns in terms of especially the Connect Long Island plan in terms of its success, and what do you think you need to get from aspiration and ambition to realization of results on the ground?
Well, it probably started when we began our work on Wyandanch Rising back in the early 2000s. It was the most economically distressed community on Long Island and had every problem imaginable: lack of infrastructure, social problems, poverty, all sorts of crime. And the one asset we started with when we looked at it in the early 2000s was we had a train station that would get you to Manhattan in a little over 50 minutes. We said, okay, that's where we're going to start. We're going to build around that. But what you quickly come to discover is that it's all connected. So Wyandanch is one train stop away, potentially, from the Route 110 corridor, which is the biggest jobs corridor in the Long Island region, one of the largest regions in the country. Just Nassau and Suffolk County is bigger than 22 states in the country. So we figure out, okay, we need to make that connection because Wyandanch residents are economically isolated. Okay, let's reopen the train station at Republic at 110. Okay, now we can connect there. Residents can wait, but they can't get to the job. So, how do you get them there? Well, we need to have a transit system that makes sense. Okay, let's implement bus rapid transit along the 110 corridor. And then you'd say, okay, now this community has been isolated for decades, all of a sudden is fully connected to the region's largest jobs corridor. And then from there, it gets bigger. And what you realize is it's all connected. Us internally within the county and the region as a whole. And connectivity is key. So in terms of the innovation zone, there we're looking at this Nichols Road corridor. We have the opportunity to connect all three lines of the railroad. We have this great transportation infrastructure on Long Island that was incredibly innovative when it was built back in the 1800s. But largely, it hasn't been built upon in any way to help us reach our economic potential in the last 150 years. So how do we do that? Well, we create a rapid transit system north-south, connect all three lines of the railroad. And at the innovation zone, we have the airport, MacArthur Airport. Every great region needs a great regional airport. That's our airport. We have an airport on Long Island, MacArthur Airport, that is immediately next to a train station. And literally, if you fly into that airport, you would have no idea that you were next to a train station. Why? And this gets to the governance stuff, and I think that's a really important point. Because this is how we do things on Long Island. The train station's here, the airport's here. So we built the terminal of the airport on the south side of the runways. And, of course, the train tracks are on the north side of the runways. So literally you have two major transportation assets that are right next to each other that are might as well be 20 miles apart, effectively. So if we make the right investment there, we have the ability now to have an airport in this region where, and the right investment would be, let's build a new state-of-the-art 21st century terminal on the north side of that airport, direct connected to the train station. Now you could walk off your plane, literally you could be in Manhattan, one-seat ride, in less than an hour out of Ronkonkoma, something you can't do from any of the three major airports in our region today. We also have, last thing I'll say on the connectivity piece, on the innovation zone there, in addition to the three lines of the railroad and the airport, we have Brookhaven National Laboratory, which is this incredible institution, global research institution, studying basic science. They're literally studying the origins of the universe moments after the Big Bang occurred. So, like, I got a D in physics, I got to be honest with you, when I was in high school. So I don't really understand everything they're doing, but I know it is absolutely amazing. And there are 6,000 scientists, soon to be up to 6,000, from around the world that are there. We have a train station that is a mile west of it, Yaphank, that about two people a year use. So we've said, why don't we shut that down, move it a mile to the east, onto BNL's property, which the tracks that were built in the 1800s just happen to run along the southern edge of BNL's property. Just build a new train station right there, call it the BNL stop, and now this global institution is now fully connected into our region's transportation infrastructure, connected to the entire region and to the innovation zone we're talking about.
So, Lynn, I have a question for you that's specific to these two initiatives. So a lot of these initiatives sit along arterials that were really designed for throughput. They were designed for speed. They were designed to move large numbers of vehicles from point A to point B without a real thought as to the context in which these roads existed within and what might eventually flourish along them. And I think when we talk about suburban retrofit, I think one of the hardest things to solve for is, like, what do we do with street networks that people are used to using in a certain way, and how do we change them given that, you know, the art of street design has really been lost. Like, when you read Alan Jacobs' books, Great Streets, and you read about all these wonderful environments that were created, or when Jane Jacobs talks about the sidewalk ballet and the interaction that happens amongst all these people, there aren't too many sidewalk ballets happening on most of our suburban arterials. So when a community decides to retrofit itself, what does it need to really go through that process? And what do you think really needs to come first to let that community go down a path that leads towards success? And do you know of any that have been successful? And if so, where are they? And what do you think we might be able to learn from them when we think about arterial and suburban retrofits in the New York region?
Okay, that feels like multiple questions,
doesn't it?
So I know Trent is asking me for a technical answer, but I'm going to answer it a slightly differently, in that I think the first thing that a community needs is leadership. Because so many communities across the United States, there are 75,000 units of local government, at the highest political level, there is a sense of fear. And how do you enable that agency to move from, I don't want to do this, this is how we've done it all the time, my residents are going to get mad at me, et cetera, to a place of, yeah, we're going to shake things up a little bit. And what Steve just talks about sounds great. It sounds almost like a unicorn, that it all went seamlessly and you didn't get any hate mail, right?
But, not yet. But, still plenty of time.
I just came from 3 days in Plano, Texas, where they were asking that same question of how do we begin to transform our arterials, and you're looking at 6-lane, 8-lane arterials. So from that perspective, working with the local government for 3 days, it really was a sense of leadership. From a more technical perspective, once you have somebody like Steve in place that says, let's go ahead and do this, really what we're finding across the country is you get the land use right, that you need to make transit-ready communities. So many folks, and absolutely this is by no means a hard and fast rule, but if you begin to create that vibrancy, that kind of demand for transit, then at the state and local level, when you're deciding where you're going to make your transit investments, it becomes clear we're going to put a BRT on this corridor, not on that corridor. So as a for example, we were working in Detroit last month doing four legacy charrettes, and we were working on a corridor trying to make it transit ready because it was number 5 on the list of who's going to get the BRT because it just didn't have the demand yet for the increased transit. So where has it been successful? So one of the great examples is the Arlington County Roslyn-Ballston corridor. And I loved how Steve just told this story. There's some points here that I'm going to underscore because he took an existing asset and he leveraged off of it. That's the first thing you need to know, and that's what Arlington did. The federal government was investing significant funds into creating an underground metro rail, and instead of following Route 66, the highway out, they directed it underground through the center of their town. Again, huge arterials, leveraging the assets. And then it took another 25 years to align the land use to get it to a point where you actually have walkability, and they did it node by node. So you took 6-lane arterials, and now you have walkability, right? And so the example there, which I think works for the New York area, is 2.9% of the land mass in Arlington County generates more than 37% of the economic base. That's incredible. That you have somewhere over 50% of the population is either car-free or only owns one car if you're talking about a 2-car household. That you've gained, that you've put almost 50,000 additional residents in the county, and traffic counts, not modeled, actual traffic counts have either remained the same or gone down. Now that's a success story. The other story that I like to talk about, and this is just one statistic, is how important it is to get the streets right. Lancaster, California, which is a suburban community that's about 80 miles northeast of LA, it has one light rail stop. It had a 5-lane arterial. They invested $13 million in streetscape improvements. They took their 5 lanes down to 2 lanes. That $13 million attracted more than $300 million in private investment. There was no economic development plan. There was no master planning. It was just, let's create a space where people and businesses can thrive, and the market will respond.
I'd like to jump in on this. I want to build on what Lynn
here
said.
Comes DOT.
But I also want to challenge the statements that you made. That
oh, brilliant!
The design is not sensitive to the context. Route 110 has probably been there for 100 years. Some path has probably been there for 200 years.
Yeah.
And originally it was designed to be a road to get people from one side of Long Island to the other. Later, after World War II, the type of land use and development was suburban, with big setbacks, seas of parking, frequent driveway cuts, and so on. And I also would say you don't have to change the standards. The standards would allow in any state DOT to build those kind of bulb outs and other things. But the context now is highly suburban. It's a road with many conflicts. It's people turning on and off. I think the most dramatic example I've ever seen is in Wasilla, Alaska, where in downtown Wasilla, the daily traffic is 35,000 cars because every big box in Alaska has been placed on Route 3. 2 miles outside of downtown, the daily traffic is 8,000. So Alaska DOT built the road that was sensitive to the context. It's a 6-lane road with multiple turning lanes because the grid was intentionally disconnected. Now, I do agree that you say that the art of good street design has been lost because we've been mechanics in my profession and simply just pounding out this kind of stuff. But the answer to this is not to simply focus in on the state DOT. It's kind of what both Steve and Lynn have been talking about. This has to be done hand in hand. In New Jersey, you were talking about the fact that we were doing some of this stuff. We were trying to do some of this stuff 10 years ago. City of Trenton came to us and asked us to turn the freeway on the waterfront into an urban boulevard. And we said, sure, but it has to go hand in hand with the redevelopment of the waterfront. Just think of what would happen if New Jersey DOT invested $150 million to create a boulevard in the parking lot in front of the State House, the very State House where we were going to our state senators and legislators and telling them we need more money, and they'd be looking out their window at us building an urban boulevard in the parking lot, and they, you know, whoever would be the commissioner would get fired and some of his staff would get fired. They did it. So this stuff has to go hand in hand. If you want a road that is sensitive to an urban context, then we have to start creating urban context side by side. And again, I'm not letting the DOTs off the hook. We've been stubborn to react to this.
Can I jump in with something? Sorry. I don't really know much about road design. Even though I grew up in the suburbs, to be honest, I'm really only beginning to learn about what's going on in much of New York suburbs. Having lived in New York City now for the past several decades and having worked in economic development in New York City for the last several decades. But what I've observed in my time since coming to RXR and spending more time in the region is that our suburban communities are facing a real challenge. And the challenge that they're facing is that they're losing vital populations to urban areas. Young professionals, they're losing empty nesters and others. And these populations are the very populations that attract businesses, and the businesses in turn create the tax base for the suburbs that allow the suburbs to offer the services that make them so appealing. And because of this reverse migration or difficulty that the suburbs are having in attracting these populations, the tax bases in many suburban communities are stagnant or declining, which means that you're amortizing rising costs across a fixed base, which in turn makes them less competitive. And somehow or another, the suburbs need to figure out how to reverse this. One way is certainly the things that you're hearing about, which is to take suburban areas and to try to make them more appealing to these populations, which generally are looking for more walkable communities, more diverse communities, areas with character. But another opportunity that the suburbs have, which I know everyone up here is in agreement on, is that especially in the New York area, we should be thinking as much about urbanizing suburbia as we should be thinking about revitalizing the urban areas in suburbia that already exist. And you know, it's great and very important for us to be thinking about putting in new modes of transit. But as we all also know, it's very costly and very difficult to do that, especially in New York for a whole host of reasons. We have an existing transit infrastructure. And in many of the places in the suburbs where that transit infrastructure goes, it's surrounded by seas of surface parking lots or downtowns that have largely been abandoned by the communities that surround them. And so I think that in addition to, and not instead of, but in addition to all the things that we're talking about, we should also make sure that when we're thinking about the future of the suburbs, we're thinking about how we revitalize these areas, which are ready-made for, at least in part, solving this fundamental problem that suburban communities are facing.
Seth, thanks for saying that, because that tees up a question I wanted to ask you. So when you look around the country, when we work on a lot of projects, we work with communities that bend over backwards to create transit-ready environments to justify a rail or a bus rapid transit investment. And this region, by definition, is sort of transit-ready because of the rail infrastructure, because of the long history and tradition that people have of using public transit. And when you look around the rail networks today, and when you look at communities that are a 30-minute ride to Manhattan or a 30-minute ride to some major job center, you don't see a real estate response that creates housing and mixed-use development along these corridors or at these nodes for people to live and work in those environments. To what would you attribute that lack of a response? Is it more of the environment's not friendly to development, the development community hasn't seen the opportunity there, the development community may not be aware that young people are not taking up driver's licenses, that we have some of the lowest levels of auto ownership in our history, and that transit's at an all-time high in terms of utilization, and walking and biking is sort of de rigueur now for the new economy and the new companies and the employees who work within them. What's what's going on that kind of depresses that real estate activity?
Well, first of all, I think it is happening increasingly. I mean, the county executive, I think, is responsible for some really innovative projects in, mm-hmm. in Suffolk County where building is occurring and changes are happening. And I think there are select communities around the region where you do see that happening. I think the answer to your question simply is yes. It's all of those things. I think you know, part of the problem is that real estate people, like I think everyone, generally like to follow trends. And if everyone is investing in the outer boroughs of New York because Brooklyn is the hot place or Queens is the hot place, then everyone else is going to follow them. But if you think about what's been driving the growth of the city's outer boroughs, what's really been happening is that people are getting priced out of prime areas. They're looking for places with an urban feel that is proximate to those prime areas. And so they're hopping on the subway and going to the next neighborhood out, the next neighborhood after that, and the next neighborhood after that. And a lot of the displacement and that people are feeling in New York City is really the logical response to the rising cost of these core areas. And the reason why costs are rising is because we're just not able to keep pace with the demand. Our supply is lagging our demand, and as anyone who knows basic economics would guess, that's driving up costs. The thing is that eventually we're going to run out of the next subway stop to go to. And the subway system is sprawling, and when you're 20 stations from Manhattan, you're far away. And what I think people should begin to realize is that the subways are not the only transit system that we have in the New York area. Our suburban transit systems are really quite an amazing asset. And in many cases, the places that those suburban transit systems go are as close, if not closer by time, to the core of Manhattan than outer borough neighborhoods. I'll just give you an illustration. We're doing major projects in both Yonkers and New Rochelle in Westchester County. It takes you about 30 minutes to get from the train station in either of those downtowns into Grand Central. I live in Brooklyn in Park Slope. It takes me about 45 minutes to get to Grand Central. But the reason why you're not seeing more of that, I think, is one, that the areas that surround these train stations, for a whole host of reasons, are often not desirable areas because the communities have not really invested in them for many, many years, and there are many reasons for that, including that that just isn't what people who moved to the suburbs for many years were looking for. And second of all, I think that the land use regulations are really anti-development and especially anti-urban development in the suburbs. But the good news, I think, if you're a believer in the notion that this is necessary to make our region sustainable and affordable, the good news is that those problems that I was talking about a minute ago that the suburbs are facing are, I think, making many communities begin to realize that unless they change, they're going to perish. And so I think you're starting to see in select areas around the region, but with growing momentum, people being willing to see a different type of development happen and realizing that these rail nodes are, in fact, a great resource for them.
I'm glad you brought up this thing about regulation, because at New Jersey Department of Transportation, when we decided to invest in, lend our consultants to communities to do land use planning, we worked in over 60 communities, and we found that one of the things that we had to do was educate them that their zoning, their design standards, their regulations made it illegal to build the kind of walkable mixed-use communities that perhaps the real estate market wants. We lent our consultant one time to a community in Sussex County, which I don't think is in your region, but they were upset because this developer was going to come in a little small burg of about 2,000 and overwhelm it with a strip mall, a suburban arterial, and separated housing and whatever. And our consultant in 3 days told the town that the developer is building exactly to your code, exactly to your zoning. And so we really, and I know you guys know this at RPA, there has to be a recognition that if we want a different kind of urban form, then we have to make it legal to build it.
So Gary, I was going to ask you a question.
Can I just jump in before you go to Gary's question? Something that Seth said, which we've been dancing around, and I think we should address it spot on, is that the suburbs are becoming the new centers of poverty in regions. And as New York, as you talked about New York, the inner burbs are increasingly becoming unaffordable. And as you begin to invest in these areas, because the supply is so high and the demand is so great, because the supply is so low, the demand is so great that the prices go up the roof, what does that say for what we are doing, and what are the strategies that we can do when we are investing and transforming these suburban landscapes to ensure that all the population is brought up, and it's just not for a certain socioeconomic demographic? It seems to me that if we are trying to have this discussion for the regional plan, that has to be front and center. We absolutely need to plan and develop communities that serve all populations. And we know what the technical solutions are. We know how to change the codes. We know how to leverage investments. But we don't know how to invest in corridors that seem decades of disinvestment in a way that doesn't push people out. So that's a question I would like to throw out.
And yeah, I think that's exactly right. And, you know, we, for instance, in Wyandotte, the focus has been, obviously, we need to create economic growth. We need to create the environments in which young people, particularly high knowledge high school workers, will find attractive, that will then also make it possible for us to bring more business to the region and create more growth. But at the same time, we're working to leverage the incredible assets we have in the region to build an innovation economy. We also have to be very focused on what are we doing to make sure that all of these communities within the county have access and entryways into that innovation economy. And for us, Wyandotte is a real model, and it's one of the reasons it's so important. You know, how do you, exactly what Lynn just said, how do you create a model where you're not just, creating economic growth and then pushing people out, but you're lifting people up? And, you know, that's a key thing we're trying to solve right now.
Thanks.
I have one before we open it up to the audience. I want to sort of challenge everybody a little bit about kind of what TOD means in the suburbs in the non-rail corridor context. I for those of you who've seen some of the images from the regional plan, many of you may have seen sort of photo simulations of this transformation of a corridor over time from a strip to Main Street. I don't believe it. I mean, I love it. I love looking at it. And I think there may be a couple places in the country. I know there's one in New Jersey, I guess. Is it Livingston? There's one that sort of approximates that. And I guess I'm just wondering, given the legacy of what we built, what is the kind of hybrid solution for some of these places that I don't really think are going to become Main Street. And I'm not even sure that they want to be or should be. So I want to challenge all of you a little bit about this idea that, because we all have an image in our heads of what a mixed-use walkable TOD is around a rail station. What are we doing in these corridors like Route 110 where it's not going to be Main Street? There may be a place along there that works that way, but what do we do with all these sort of hybrid conditions that don't really fit that ready model?
To a certain extent, you have to pick certain areas and say, yeah, we're going to let this place be what it is, and it's, you know, that's what it is. You can't spread out the investments because you get into a frame of mind that you'd like to see every place be a walkable, that's just not reality. You've got to focus the investments on the places where you have the best opportunities. And I can think of a lot of different places where they're just regular commercial corridors. It's fast food restaurants, gas stations, auto shops and things like that. And that's what they're going to be. On the 110 corridor, there's the place where you have this opportunity. You're not going to create necessarily a Main Street along the corridor, although I think the corridor needs to become a 21st century roadway, where you're then creating nodes of transportation in a, say, rapid transit system, and now you're developing around those. You know, the old, office complex, as we've known it in suburbia, is ultimately going to go the way of the dodo bird and the drive-in movie theater in suburbia. It's just an inefficient use. And the reason, the main driver that's going to be is we can't move around the island anymore. If we're developing in a way, the infrastructure is simply going to force it. If we're developing in a way that's adding more cars to the roadway, we don't have more space to just keep adding lanes. So even if that made sense. So we're going to have to develop differently around nodes of transportation. And then you have that mixed-use element, not just an office park, but a mixed-use element around those nodes. But a corridor that's multimodal.
And I would expand on what Steve is saying, because it's just not looking at the nodes around transit, but looking at the nodes of where you have other infrastructure investments or other assets, be it a major employer, be it a school, a university, access to open space. Absolutely, when you're looking at a 20-mile or 40-mile, 110, excuse me, corridor, there are going to be winners and losers. There's going to be nodes. And I think that it's false, particularly when you're looking across the New York area, to say only focus on rail. Absolutely, what Seth said, focusing on bus as well, but that's what I meant by transit ready. Not every place is transit ready. Where are the assets where you can get that land use vibrancy going, and then it becomes obvious to put in additional transit there or to put in different modes of transportation? Mm-hmm. So that's the winners and losers. And the other piece, too, is that you're not going to see it overnight. The Arlington County example took three decades. It took us decades to get into the situation. It's going to take us decades to move out. And the only way to start is thinking about it in incremental steps. I loved how Steve talked about this. We had a rail station that went in, so let's do that. Oh, but a mile away we had this. Okay, now we're going to do this. That's exactly how you're going to start attacking these larger arterials. And some places are going to be losers.
Well, I'm going to go back to what Lynn said, too, in terms of the political leadership, and what County Executive Ballone is doing is a perfect example of it. You're going to need that consistent leadership to pick your spots and hold the course. There's an example in New Jersey on Route 33 called Washington Town Center, which is about 5 miles east of Trenton. And the mayor and a state elected official and the town planner doggedly kept after us. We did everything we possibly could at New Jersey Department of Transportation to stop the creation of this town center on the state highway. They stuck with it, and if you go there now, you'll see it's not very long. It's pick your spot, but there's an area with buildings that are right on top of the roadway. There's a fantastic walkable mixed-use area next to it, and I don't know this for sure, but it's probably a bus stopping there now, because when it opens its door, some dried up grass doesn't blow into the bus. People come onto the bus.
I don't really know the answer to your question. I think it's hard to retrofit areas that have developed a certain way. You look at a city like Los Angeles, where they've invested billions of dollars to create a pretty impressive mass transit system, but its ridership is still comparatively low because the way people live is still based on a different model, and so it's hard for people to access that mass transit. But I, not to sound like a broken record, but it's kind of my personality, so I will. I think while we're doing all those things, which are important, there's an easier, lower-hanging fruit in the suburbs, which is rather than trying to create Main Street where Main Street doesn't exist, let's go back to the Main Street that actually already is there and invest in it.
If it's there.
But the beauty of New York, and it's less, I think, in Suffolk County than in some of the closer-in suburbs, is that we have a lot of Main Streets that exist. This is not Texas. This is not the suburbs north of Minneapolis, where I also lived. These are downtowns that were the hearts of their communities for many, many years and then were largely abandoned, but have lots of the characteristics that the very populations that these suburbs are desperate to hang on to are looking for. So in addition to all of that, I hope that we also, look back at these downtowns and make sure that we're focusing on them as well.
And we do have those downtowns, a number of them in Suffolk County, and you can see some of them have been undermined by the effects of suburbanization within the downtown core, where buildings are set off from the street, and you can see where the suburban developments took place that have undermined the downtown. But, there are a number of them that exist.
So as I suspected, the conversation was going to take a life of its own. It was going to be really interesting. So the moderator role is pretty simple. Before we open it up to a broader dialogue, I wanted to ask each of you, maybe, Gary, we could start with you and work our way back over to Executive Bologne. It's like, what's your thought or thoughts summarized in just a few sentences of what a regional plan could do and what it should do to help kind of advance the ideas that we've all been discussing to address some of the issues that Rob hit on in his presentation? Like, what is that plan's function and how can it address some of the issues you were bringing up about social equity and bringing everybody along with us and create kind of a different environment in our suburban communities?
I think we have to start thinking about moving beyond plans and figuring out a way for organizations like RPA and CNU to assist with the implementation of the plans. Because, as Lynn pointed out, we know what to do. It's been discovered and rediscovered over and over again. What we now have to figure out is how to clone more county executives like Steve, but to deal with the political and socioeconomic ecosystem that time after time breaks down every attempt to implement plans like the RPA puts out.
Thanks.
It's interesting. If you look at the New York region, in many ways, we are one of, if not the most dynamic regions in the world. Our economy is thriving, and we are competitive with any city on the face of the planet. But the big challenges that we face are, one, that success is not spread evenly throughout the region, and two, that because it's especially concentrated in our urban core, namely New York City, that costs are rising and affordability is becoming a real issue, not just for individuals and households, but also for businesses. The only way that we're going to address that second issue is by spreading the success over a larger land area. But doing it in a way where we're not creating sprawl, where those regions lose touch with each other, or where you end up with gridlock because people can't get from one place to another. And, if you want to solve the affordability challenge, I have become a firm believer that the only way that we're going to do that, it's not by spending billions of dollars on trying to squeeze more affordable housing in the five boroughs of New York City, although that's an important policy too. The way that we're going to do that is we're going to have to solve this problem regionally. And I'll just throw one statistic out, which is that in the downtown redevelopments that we at RXR are building, the market rate rents in the apartments that we're creating there on a per square foot basis are actually lower than the affordable rents at the highest levels that are being built in New York City. So if you want to make sure that we're addressing equity, if you want to make sure that we're addressing affordability, the way that you do that is that you widen your lens of focus and you look at the opportunities in the whole region.
I think the four comments that Rob started with were good, and I would add one more in addition to the social equity, which is aligning infrastructure investments. There is so much money that is being spent that goes from the federal government to the states to the local government, and yet it is not spent in a way. If we want the outcomes, if we want placemaking outcomes, let's align our infrastructure investments in a way that fosters multiple community outcomes. Let's ensure that we're doing green infrastructure that not only manages our stormwater, but also creates, attractive streets. If we're going to be spending billions of dollars on climate change issues, which I know New York is, let's make sure that we're meeting multiple community outcomes. The era of single objective spending is over. As a region, you can no longer afford to invest just in affordable housing, just in transit, just in schools. You absolutely have to align your infrastructure investments to meet multiple community outcomes. And coming from RPA, sending that strong message to all the local and state governments would be huge.
I think the recommendation, I agree with all that. I think the recommendation about creating some sort of a regional entity that requires not just discussion, but some sort of planning to be put forward, planning consensus to be put forward, is very important, because particularly in the Long Island region, very, very decentralized government structure, it makes it very difficult to move forward. And I am constantly pitching the idea to colleagues out on Long Island that, look, we have our local responsibilities. You know, we're very good at, you know, addressing local community issues. But what we haven't been great at is understanding that we, as policymakers and elected officials, we also have regional responsibilities. And whether you care about the region or not, you know, you should, because if you only care about the local, the stuff that has to happen at the regional level impacts every single family and community within the region. So if even if you're only concerned about the local, you still have to be focused on your regional responsibilities. And it's very difficult. You know, we put forward a proposal, and the governor has really pushed us towards that, creating regional economic development councils that are talking about coming together and talking about where funding should be going, but it needs. We need more focus and more coordinated planning before those funds get delivered. So we need to see that progress. But we put forward a proposal, regional planning alliances, that said basically this, to give you a sense of the difficulties of this, that said if you are looking to move forward a project that has regional significance to it, and you're seeking county infrastructure dollars to implement it as a local municipality, then you have a requirement to meet with the county and our planning people regarding that regionally significant project 4 times a year. There's no other obligation except just meeting to coordinate on planning on a project you want to put forward. We had to struggle to get that passed, and when you're seeking millions of dollars in county funding, we had to struggle to get that passed. And literally, I had to say to some colleagues, so you have an issue with just talking, but there's such an aversion to taking away local control that something that doesn't even remotely do that, in any way is threatening.
You know, the interesting thing, though, we found, because we went real big at this whole concept with our Office of State Planning in New Jersey DOT. We sort of led it because we had the ability to hire consultants and actually engage the planners. But that was our biggest fear, too, because New Jersey, home rule state, said people aren't going to give up the local control. At the elected official level and at the other sort of level, people said exactly what you said. So we went out and said, we're going to go try to work with 60 communities, and if we get 5, we'll consider it a success. 58 out of the 60 communities, the first one we went to actually said to us, where have you guys been all these years? We are overwhelmed. We know that just competing with each other is killing us all, and we're hoping somebody would come in and sort of regulate this effort. Our worst fear at New Jersey DOT when we started this was we're going to kicked out of most of these towns. It later became people started applying and calling up the New Jersey DOT and saying, can you start one of those corridor studies in my town? And the same thing happened with the developers and the real estate developers who were building all sorts of disconnected things. And they said to us, we'd be willing to do all this stuff because we know it's better and more sustainable for us and we might even make more money. But we just need to make sure that you guys, and he was pointing to us and our Department of Environmental Protection, make sure that my neighboring developer does the same thing. We don't want to be the fool that comes in there and builds all this cool stuff, and then the next guy gets a hold of his buddy, an elected official on the golf course, and he gets away with murder.
Sorry. So, great comments. Wonderful discussion. And I'm sure people out there would like to ask a few questions. So we do want to provide some time for Q&A. I suspect you'll get your comment in and the answer to a question. So if people, people in the audience have questions, if you could raise your hands.
We'll go sort of around the room like this, starting back there.
Yeah. There is a lot of nice plans. There are some nice ideas, well-organized plans. But whenever they go to the people who decide if that can be done or not can be done, they die. So what's our main problem? How to get the right people in the right place so they will let the good things to the community. People that don't think in themselves, but people who really think in the community. How are we going to deal with that problem? They should be here, but they're not. They're not interested.
Yeah, so I'm going to make Steve answer that as the elected official.
Well, yes, I would.
So can I let him answer?
I will address Steve and Lynch.
So you need to do community-based planning so that the community is coming to the elected officials and saying, this is what we want. We want this to happen. And I have found almost universally, whenever you do good community planning and get people to understand what are the things that need to happen in order to make what they'd like to see at the end happen, they will support it. Politicians are risk averse. They're not without the, most people in the region in policymaking positions, I think, would say, to projects that are of any significance or maybe challenge, would say, well, if the community's for it, then, let me know if the community's backing you, if a developer comes in or anything else, which is sort of a odd way to do it. You should be doing good community-based planning in your communities, and if you're doing that, the communities then are directing and pushing forward those projects.
And just one quick follow-on, right? If you have a plan for a project, at the same time the plan is improved, align your land development regulations to make it legal to build. Gary said that, and I want to underscore it. Probably the number one barrier of why we're not getting the type of development that we want, apparently you all are some sort of unicorn that you do it so well, is local land development regulations. Between the setbacks, the height limits, the minimum acreage standards, the stormwater, the street, it's all embedded in the codes. Developers aren't bad people. They just follow the rule book. Change the rule book, you're going to get better development.
Well, and when you change the rule book, you need to make sure that the people who are actually going to be asked to build are at the table.
Ooh, good one. Yeah.
And, we in New Rochelle, for example, just went through a master developer process with the city that was very heavily engaged with the public, which was a very important part of the process, where we were listening to people and asking them what they wanted to see before we came forward with a plan, which I think is a critical part of the process, rather than coming to the table and saying take it or leave it, but you actually hear from people what they want and then shape a plan around them. But the second important part was that the master developer, who would be the entity that was actually going to have to put the money in and make these buildings do what everyone promised they were going to do, we were at the table from the beginning. And so when the public said, I want X and Y, we would say, well, you can get X or you can get Y, but it's hard to get both. Let's talk about how to compromise and make this work. That's actually part of the plan rather than something that has to be corrected afterwards. Mm-hmm.
So can we make a request of our audience? When you're asking a question, first keep it brief. And please make sure it's a question so that our panelists can answer the question you're trying to ask. And that'll help us get more of you at the microphone so we can get more questions answered over the next few minutes that we have left.
We're going around this way, I guess.
Hi, thank you. Bob Knight. My company works with real estate, government, and healthcare industries in the suburbs. So one thing that's glaring to me here, especially when we looked at the Central Avenue corridor, is the complexion of retail is changing with internet retailers such as Amazon. And the question to the panel is, are there examples of communities around the nation where the planning and zoning folks have come to the realization that that's going to force a lot of change in some of these suburban corridors, and what's going to come in its place? Thanks.
Oh, well, Well, actually, I can take that. What we're finding across the country as a very first step, so I'm big on the incremental because it's such a big time horizon, that the big box is actually being reused. You're seeing the big box being readapted for churches, be adapted for schools, be adapted for libraries. And a lot of what I suggest to folks is just kind of public engagement, civic involvement, have it as a theater. Just don't have it sitting empty. And it begins to create a demand for the space. The problem with just reusing the box is that it doesn't change the underlying land use pattern. You're not connecting up the gridded streets. You're not transforming the arterial. So the other piece that we're finding, particularly with the transformation of the suburban strip, again, an incremental approach, is putting in liner buildings that can be transitional, that you're using shipping crates, et cetera, that you're putting in a Christmas market or a summer flower market, that you're beginning to create these temporary uses that are insanely local that will support. And then finally, using it as economic incubators, where you're doing creating a series of policies as well as land use choices to identify and support your local businesses, because that is A, not only sustainably supporting your local economies, but also providing one of many drivers for land use changes.
I said I'd work my way around this way. Was there, who's the next counterclockwise or clockwise person in the back there?
Hi, thank you. I'm Elaine Clisham from New Jersey Future. I want to go back to the road design question, if I could. And if you buy the distinction between a road, which is intended to move people efficiently from one location to another, and a street, which is supposed to be an agglomeration of a vibrant mix of uses where some density is a good thing rather than a bad thing, I would submit that some of the suburban corridor examples we've been looking at are what Chuck Marone calls strodes, which are the worst elements of both. And in some cases, is there ever any consideration given to the idea that most of the traffic on a strode is local, trying to access these local destinations? And how do you get the local traffic off the road, close down some of the access points so that you can improve efficiency on the road and maybe have the local traffic take advantage of a more densified, interconnected local street network on either side of the road? So I wasn't here. I didn't hear a lot of conversation about that.
10 years ago, New Jersey DOT partnered with Pennsylvania DOT to create something called the Smart Transportation Guide for Pennsylvania and New Jersey. We worked with communities, and we worked with New Jersey Future back then, and created guidance for that. And one of the ways to do it is to connect the grid, stop building disconnected grids, so that everybody's not forced on the big road. Another way to do it is, if you don't want a strode, then don't try to design it as a main street and a major through route at the same time, so it has to do with land use. So if you Google Smart Transportation Guide for Pennsylvania and New Jersey, or Pete, I'm sure, has it, your executive director, because he was a little bit a part of that, the guidance is there.
Darius, and then...
Darius Solahub, New Jersey Institute of Technology. My question is, what are the new paradigms? I think all of you are operating well within existing paradigms. I mean, Steve, you got an interesting laugh line when you described the LIR as being a 19th century, advanced technology. And the CNU, started by reviving a 20th century paradigm of town planning. But, I mean, shouldn't we be thinking about what does an Uber-oriented development look like? Or how seriously do we take autonomous vehicles? Or, what are these new infrastructures going to say about a fourth plan?
I think this is what Rob was saying in the beginning. I'm sorry,
I cut you off. Go, go, go.
What Rob was saying in the beginning is that you put in the major spokes of using your bus rapid transit or your rail, and then I use the word permeability, you use irrigate, of how you use these new systems of autonomous driving vehicles, of Uber, of the wide range of walking, biking, to integrate that kind of last mile. And I would maintain that we're not just talking about the last mile anymore. We're talking about, the last 2 or 3 miles of really creating that transit node becomes the center of the spoke, and it radiates out. That's the new paradigm. How can we leverage the sharing economy? Increasingly, that's what we're finding in our own work, that it's not a downtown or a suburbs, it's an and, that we need to have a healthy and thriving rural economy, rural development, to have healthy, thriving suburbs, to have a healthy, thriving downtown. I really appreciated Seth's pivot back to the downtown because he's absolutely right. But at the same time, how can we create nodes of activity in our suburbs and at the same time also support our rural areas? And I understand talking rural, and I'm from upstate New York, right? But so when we talk about New York, it's important to me. There's an incredible agricultural economy that supports. How can we begin to integrate that, irrigate it, create that permeability across all different modes and land uses?
Governance structure is important here. To the point you were speaking about is the region's ability to adapt quickly to changing circumstances. Government is the least capable institution of reacting quickly or changing quickly to changing circumstances. So we need to change that so that, you know, we can thrive in a rapidly moving 21st century global economy. Now, with respect to like things like Uber and driverless cars, you know, those are things that are going to strengthen the ability to do what we're talking about. So to the extent that we can build out sort of this quality of life ecosystem that is really well connected, these series of innovation campuses around our transit nodes that offer people the ability to rent an apartment right next to where they work, which does not exist fundamentally on Long Island today, but you'll be able to do. And then you can hop from different downtowns, and now you can go to the different lines of the railroad. But to the extent you can't do that, you have the option to use Uber. You have the option of a driverless vehicle. You have Zipcar. You have all of these things that make it more possible for you to live in a suburban environment without having to get in an automobile. And that is the environment that we have to create and the environment we have to build in suburbia if we're going to reach our economic potential.
Well, and just one other point. Yeah. None of the things that you described change the fundamental underlying truth of the following statement, which is that everything is always more efficient with greater density. And so whether people are traveling by rail or by Uber or by Zipcar, it's easier to deliver all of those things if more people are closer together than if more people are spread farther apart.
At a certain moment, in the next few minutes, we will see Lynn fade away and run out the door to catch her train to Boston to make her next speaking gig, which will be tonight at 6:30. So I'm sure you don't want to leave, but I know when you do depart, it'll be the moment where you feel you can no longer remain with us because you have to catch a train.
Thank you. I have
Kevin, and then
Kevin Corbett. Steve, just to pick up on a couple of comments, as well as Gary, and certainly Seth and I worked in my previous job where I was the head of Empire State Development, and condemnation was something we took great pride in. I say that joking, but it is true. If you look at, you know, at one point the city was five boroughs, and then you became city, and you had neighborhoods, and we'd take on various projects, and of course you had ULIP versus CECRA, but it gets into the governance structure that you just touched on, Steve, is that when you do, if you do have community-based, you know, planning and involvement, it comes up so the electeds don't have to be worried about touching a third rail. And Gary, you mentioned where even the town didn't want it and the developer didn't want it. But the laws, at least in New York State, you do have the UDC Act and you can do friendly condemnation. There are some tools, but because of the home rule and other issues, people never politically wanted to touch that. But the question I have, you know, for the whole panel is, do you have some tools that aren't being used, you know, maybe because of political calculus or whatever, that repackaged could be useful to really accelerating, you know, in the areas where there is consensus? And or if not, is it possible to get some kind of legislation or some kind of thing to take that will start allowing the, or at least if not forcing it in the old Robert Moses ways, to provide the counties and the municipalities that do want to embrace it to be able to have some vehicle for without having to go through a whole, you know, rezoning of everything?
I think we're using every tool in the tool chest to try to advance projects that we have available to us. So I would say the next evolution at the state level, and I think it would have to happen at the state level, is really creating a more structured regional environment for that essentially requires local municipalities to come together and incentivizes through resources that are coming down, it's been discussed, to get together and plan together about the region, you know, and really force us to break out of just our like hyper-local focus to say, hey, you know what? You get elected to this position, you also have some regional responsibilities that you have to address.
I'm a little bit more of a cynic. So as Rob said, I worked at the US EPA for more than 15 years, and so I have a national perspective, and I can tell you that there are so many state policies that are in play of what happened in Wisconsin that they passed through the legislature through tons of brain damage and didn't work. In Arizona, passed, didn't work. In Massachusetts, passed, didn't work. Because when it comes down to it, it's not the kind of legislation that requires planning or conversation. It requires the leadership at every single level of government to say, this is what we need to do. And frankly, I would go a step further in that it's up to the state to start assigning the dollars for that. Steve keeps mentioning incentives. There is so much money that goes to the localities here that comes from the states, and how about saying you're not going to get your, it's not going to be a pass-through anymore. You have to talk to your neighbor in order to get this money.
Yep.
No state is willing to take that step.
And we keep talking about governance, and I should let you know that PPS, Project for Public Spaces, has a major grant to work with the Brookings Institute on a concept called place governance. And it's all about accomplishing a lot of what County Executive Ballone was talking about creating the community vision, what Lynn was talking about breaking the era of single-purpose public investment is over. And so Brookings and PPS are looking at all the impediments to this and in how government at all levels, local, federal, state, can be sort of restructured somewhat to create the 21st century vision that Darius was talking about how to focus and be more successful on this.
One, I think we have time for one more question.
Quantel Basemore, IFCA Housing Network, and also an elected official in the village of Ossining. So my question is, particularly for you, New York State has a New York State Housing Finance where they offer developers like an 80-20. From a local level, how do we encourage developers to take part in that so that we can create more a greater level of affordability in the new construction?
I mean, the bottom line is that unless you're going to require it, which some jurisdictions do, that the math has to work. You know, the loss of revenue from turning 20% of your market units into affordable units has to be outweighed economically by the benefit that you're getting from the government subsidy. And when it's not, if it's voluntary, people won't use it, and when it is, people will. So it's really about properly calibrating those incentives.
Maybe we do have time for one more. It looks like a few minutes.
Hi, Doug Hamilton, Arkelia Architecture. As an architect and urban designer who has done retail and mixed-use projects in the suburbs, parking was always the biggest design obstacle to creating great places. Now with ride-sharing and other autonomous vehicles and other things coming up, what's the process by which we get to more rational zoning on parking?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've been looking at this in our suburban downtown developments, and, yeah, you know, parking is a huge impediment to the economic model of developing in these areas, because so much of your development potential is eaten up by the space that you're creating for parking, and it's generally not a money maker. The problem is that we're in a transition period, and it's hard to know exactly where we're going to end up. And so you have to build for the market that you're in, you know, we're seeing less private car use among people who live in suburban downtowns, but it's not a dramatic change so far, but it could be. So I think, I mean, the answer is, which is probably not a satisfactory answer, but the answer is I think that, you know, we probably are not in a place yet where we can radically change the rules, because the demand hasn't radically changed, but we should watch it closely because it could, and it could happen quickly.
And we know, when the ecosystem sort of more fully built out and there are a lot more places that you can connect to and the things that you connect to, and you can make more rational choices about where you are going to live and work based on that ecosystem, that you'll see that start to change. And that's one of the things we're actually looking at, doing a countywide parking plan.
study. And you know, a lot of parking generation rates are based on some fairly limited studies, mostly in very suburban environments. There's now an online resource. It's called tripgenie.org, and it has hundreds of parking and trip generation rate alternatives to use for different types of built environments that have different features, different types of land uses. So you can take the ITE recommendation, get a data set from a different source, and then maybe think about doing something a little bit less. What happens when you mix in car sharing? What happens when you mix in other modes? So it can help you at least have a counterpoint to what ITE will tell you you need to do in terms of the trip generation rates, which usually underpin most local jurisdictions' requirements for parking. Right, we have to wrap up?
Yeah, I was going to say.
I want to say that thank you all for coming. I think that the discussion, the questions, the dialogue has really been very timely. It's been interesting, but I think also from a fourth regional plan point
really
of view,
helpful.
It's going to be very helpful and very productive in terms of shaping new initiatives and new directions for the plan.
Yeah,
so thank
and,
you
and
all.
If you have more thoughts for me and for the regional plan, please get in touch with me because we are still developing this recommendation. I got a lot out of the discussion this morning, but please approach me or send me an email, whatever, about other ideas that you may have. So you could join me in just thanking the panelists and Trent. Thank you very much.